this time I'd like to introduce our first speaker. It's Rashima P.
Thanks. I'm an addict named Rashima.
Hi,
Rashima. Hi, family. God, it is so good to be clean. I am so happy to be here. This is my 9th Chesapeake Potomac Regional Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. And I come back every year because I just get a spiritual charge from being here. No matter what happens, if I don't like the speakers, if my friends piss me off, I leave here feeling so much better. If it's only from the high that I get from being in the Clean Time Countdown and just hearing however many thousand other addicts screaming, keep coming back. It just sends me home feeling so refreshed and alive and excited about my recovery. So I'm really, really glad to be here again this year. But there's one little small part in my heart that is just a little bit sad this weekend. And it comes from some of the things I've seen this weekend, some behaviors I've seen. And I don't know, this convention saved my life. I truly believe that. And, you know, there's one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. It's an attitude of indifference or intolerance to spiritual principles. Selflessness is a spiritual principle. If you don't know what it means thinking about somebody else instead of thinking of yourself. And some of the stuff that I've seen, it's not selfless behavior. And I'll just be straightforward with you. What I'm talking about is this is a meeting. After the Serenity Prayer is said, once you hear it, you should probably, maybe, if you want, consider shutting the fuck up because there is a meeting going on. And, you know, if your cell phone rings, it shouldn't be ringing to begin with, but maybe you might want to think about not answering it and having a conversation during the meeting on your cell phone. Like I said, this convention saved my life. You know, I have to think about the other people that are in here. We owe it to each other to respect each other and to, you know, let each other hear the message. I don't know why y'all are here, but I'm here because I came to hear a message of recovery. That means I need to be able to hear it. So I just had to get that little rant out and off my chest before I started. So thank y'all for letting me rant. I'll stop now. The first time I ever used, I was about 14 years old. I didn't use a whole lot around that time. I used a little bit in high school. I used a little bit in college. Nothing too major, nothing. You know, my life was still pretty manageable. I was still getting decent grades, you know. My parents hadn't kicked me out of the house or anything like that. Things were okay. But what changed my life in the direction of everything, and I do believe today that what happened to me was the best thing for me, considering some of the things that I was doing with myself. It was December 1992, and I was in a really, really, really bad car accident, head-on collision on the highway, and I was in a Toyota MR2, so if you know the car, there's nothing in the front but, you know, air, and in the back is the engine. So when that car hit me head-on, it was pretty bad. And I woke up in the hospital, and I was pretty broken up. I had about 12 broken bones, teeth were knocked out, skull was fractured, and I was 20 years old, and, you know, it just changed my life. The more significant thing that happened that changed my life was while I was in the hospital, they gave me a drug. And needless to say, from the second that chemical hit my system, I was gone. And no matter how upset I was about my situation, I couldn't walk for 3 months. I was in a wheelchair. There was a bunch of different stuff going on. I always knew that I would walk again, but I couldn't. I knew I couldn't. Wouldn't be allowed to walk for 3 months. When they gave me that chemical, everything was okay. It didn't matter what the situation was, how desolate it looked. Everything was okay. Everything was fine. Like, everything was just all right. And I said to myself, I like this, and I want to feel like this for the rest of my life. And after that point, that's what I proceeded to try and do, was chase that feeling and chase that numbness and not ever have to worry about anything again. And I did whatever I needed to do to get more. When my disease told me to do something, I did it. Whatever it was, I did it to get, you know, my drug of choice and to try and maintain that feeling. And of course, we all know, there comes a point when you can't numb, no matter how numb you are, it's just too much. At least that's what happened for me. I couldn't handle anything anymore. I hated myself. I hated my life. I wanted to die. And, you know, that was just the way my story was. And I remember at the end, everything just seemed so hopeless and so desolate, and I didn't think that there was anything I could do about it. I thought there were only two options. One, to keep doing what I was doing, which I couldn't do anymore. It was killing me. I was dead inside, and physically I was dying too, and I couldn't do it anymore. Or the second option, to kill myself. And I remember sitting in my apartment thinking about, you know, just how many bags is it going to take, you know, to take myself out, and how long. I was in Philadelphia at the time. My family's from Maryland. How long would it take them to find me? And, you know, I kind of did the math in my head, and it was very close to Mother's Day. And after my car accident, before the using got really bad, I had tried to kill myself, and my parents had found me. And I remember them taking me to ICU and me cussing them out for calling the ambulance and not letting me die. And a voice said to me, you cannot do that to your mother again on Mother's Day. And I had my first conscious contact with God, as I understand God, and said, try to get clean. I had been to treatment a couple of times before, but it, you know, a couple weeks, got out, used, whatever. And I honestly, did not think that I could get clean. I didn't think it was for me. So if you're out there and if you're not sure if you can do it or not, just know the message of this program, I don't know about the message of any other programs, the message of Narcotics Anonymous is that an addict, any addict, even you, can stop using, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. You can do it. I didn't think I could do it at the time, and I had my first conscious contact with God, and it said, just try to get clean one more time. And I called my parents, and I left Philly. I came back to Frederick, Maryland, and proceeded to start the process of getting clean. I didn't just walk into my first meeting, get clean, and, you know, stay clean from thenceforth. I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous while I was still on methadone. And, you know, that's just my story. I'm not saying get on it. I'm not saying it's a good thing. That's just what happened for me. It slowed me down enough so that I could come here. And when I got here, you know, I eventually finished my detox and, you know, went to treatment again. But what happened to me when I got here was the most amazing thing. The most amazing thing that's ever happened to me. I finally felt at home. I finally felt like I fit in. I found other people that understood the way I had felt when I was out there, when I wanted to die, when my life was shit, when I just was failing at life, you know, and that's what I was doing. I was failing at life. I wasn't even, you know, living and breathing successfully as far as I was concerned. You guys understood that, and you told me it didn't have to be like that anymore. And then you showed me how it didn't have to be like that anymore. And I don't know. I had 53 days clean when I came to my first convention here. It was number 10. And Like I said earlier, it changed my whole life. It changed my whole recovery. The things that I heard here, the message of Narcotics Anonymous, a clear message of Narcotics Anonymous, a strong message of Narcotics Anonymous. I learned what to do, and most specifically, at the relationships meeting that year, a woman from Free State named Janet G. was one of the speakers, and she said, you know, there's no must in NA, but if you want what I have, then you have to do what I did. You have to do what I did. Not I suggest you do what I did. She said, if you want what I have, you have to do what I did. And I was like, what? And she said five things. Go to meetings, many meetings. Work steps with a sponsor. Get a relationship with the God of your understanding and do service. And I took that, I internalized, and I've always held on to that ever since then, and I still do. That's how I work my program. That is what working the Narcotics Anonymous program means to me. And if you start there, it's a great start. I've always believed that that was all there was to it, that's do those five things and you'll be set. But when I got asked to do this workshop, I started thinking about it some more, and I started thinking about some people who I love who continually relapse for whatever reason. And I've seen people do those five things. You know, I don't know to what extent they're doing them, not my business, but I've seen people do those five things and still use. So I started thinking about it, you know, what's missing? What else is there? So for me, there are certain tools that I've learned over the years that I need to use to not relapse. Because relapse is not necessary. It's a reality, but it's not necessary. And I know there's a ton of tools out there to not relapse. But I'm just going to talk about the ones that are the most important for me. The ones that I've learned, the ones that I utilize the most. The first one is gratitude. I don't know if it's in the basic text, but I've heard it said many times, a grateful addict will never use. And what that means for me is, no matter how full of self-pity I am, no matter what is going on in my life, there are some things that I have that I can be grateful for. I have some clean time today. I have a wonderful, wonderful husband who loves me very much. And doesn't just say he loves me, he actually behaves as though he loves me too, which is new for me. It's easy to say. You know, I have a wonderful, wonderful family who loves me. I have great friends. You know, I have people who care about me today. That's some stuff on my gratitude list. But even if I didn't have any of those things I just said, I told you, I spent 3 months in a wheelchair. I can walk today. You know, and if I didn't have that, I can see today. I can hear today. And even if I didn't have that, my father wrote me a letter several years after my car accident. And the gist of it was, he was walking around the hospital that I was in. And just feeling, you know, upset and sad for me. And, you know, I mean, I'm an only child. You know, I was laying in the hospital for 3 months. My dad was upset for me, you know. And I'm sure upset for himself and my mother. And he was walking through the hospital, and he saw another father in there. And that man's daughter, she's a couple years older than me, but still very young. She was about 25 years old. And my father saw the look in that man's eyes, and God, gratitude, because that man's daughter was brain dead in the room down from mine. And I'm alive today. If nothing else, I have that. So if you're out there and you're thinking that, you know, you don't have anything to be grateful for, think about some of those things. Because you do. And that's, you know, that's one tool that I've learned how to use, that it never fails me. You know, even under the worst circumstances, I can always think of at least five things that maybe I might not be feeling grateful for them, but I damn well should be feeling grateful for them, and I don't need to use. Another tool that I've had to use to stay clean and not relapse is I have to learn when it's my disease that's talking to me. Not just my subconscious, not, you know, my mother's voice, not whatever's voice. I need to learn that voice of my disease, and it is always back there. It's always going. I need to learn how to know that that's what that voice is, that it's just my disease, and learn how to tell it to shut the fuck up and stop jacking with me. And, you know, what happens? I suffer from low self-esteem, and, you know, my disease is probably the main culprit of that. You know, I learned to listen to that shit. And I can't, the worse and worse my disease took me, the more and more I started believing those things that it, those lies it told me, that I was a piece of shit, that I was never going to be successful at anything, that nobody was ever going to love me, and I was damn sure never going to learn how to love myself, and that I was always going to fail at whatever I did, so why are you even fucking trying again? That is my disease, and I don't need to listen to that shit. And even when I do, I mean, there's sometimes that I go there, and I let it, I listen. I listen to the lies, and sometimes I believe the lies. But that's when I need to do something like pick up the phone and talk to another addict or call my sponsor or carry my butt to a meeting, read my basic text, something, say a prayer, and just not listen. Even if I do believe it for those 10 minutes or that day or that week, I don't use about it. Another tool that I use, I've had to learn how to survive emotions since I got here. I don't know about y'all, but I have a lot of emotions. I'm an extremely emotional person, and it seems like the longer I stay clean, the more emotional I get, which I hate. But, you know, I've had to learn that no matter how bad I feel, no matter how angry, resentful, sorry for myself, sick, disgusted, sad, humiliated, that was a big one for me. No matter how much I feel that stuff, I do not have to use about it. Sometimes it's all I can do. Like I said, I work steps, I do service, I do all that stuff. Sometimes all I can do is sit there and white knuckle it and just feel however fucked up I feel. You know, and I'm not talking about when I had 30 days clean. I'm talking about last month, you know, last week, whatever. You know, still with a couple years clean. My emotions will take me to that place where I don't feel like I can go on. And I want to, you know, I don't know, jump off my balcony. I think there's a live wire, like, off the back of my balcony. I know the home inspector guy said if I touched, like, a metal ladder to it, I'd fry. And sometimes I go there. You know, I think about, well, what happened? You know, when I'm that down and when I'm that upset, I go there. But I don't have to use and I don't have to hurt myself. If I just stick tight, don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle and hold on, I get through it. And the feeling, the emotion, whatever it is, eventually it goes away or it gets not so bad. So that's another one I've learned. I have to stay vigilant. I have to stay vigilant to not relapse and to stay around this program. And that means a lot of different things for a lot of different people. What it means for me is those first five things I said, meeting, step, sponsor, service, God. I have to keep doing those when I don't want to, when I do want to, and every other time. No matter what's going on. You know, there's been some times in my recovery when, you know, I did things that made me humiliated or made me feel like an outsider again. And there's been a few times where I was like, you know what? I'm not going to meetings anymore. I don't want to see those people. I don't want them to see me. Whatever, whatever. And usually, like, when I say that, like, around noon, I usually end up in a meeting that night. Not necessarily because I really want to be there, but because I know that that's what I have to do, and I don't want to get high. I couldn't do it the first time. I know I can't do it the second time. I have a lot of not yets, and you know, I was damn near dead before without even going to see all the not yets. And they say a smart man learns from his mistakes, but a wise man learns from other people's mistakes. And I've heard enough people tell me it doesn't get any better. And you know, it was bad enough for me, so I'm not trying to go back out. So even when things are good, it means I still have to keep working steps. I still have to keep going to meetings. You know, it just doesn't stop for me. And to me, that's what staying vigilant means. And the last, I'm running a little bit short, I think, but the last tool that I use for me, and it's the most powerful tool in my arsenal against the disease, it's the God of my understanding. And I save it for last because for me, I struggle with working on my relationship with God and developing that relationship and maintaining that relationship. I still struggle with it to this day. When I'm in pain, it's not the first thing that comes to my mind is to pray for help with it. The first thing that comes to my mind is to somehow control something that's going to make it stop, which, you know, doesn't really work. But, you know, and I'll think of go to a meeting, I'll think of talk to somebody, I'll think of all that other stuff, and it's always, for me, because like I said, I struggle with it. For me, it's always the last thing. Why don't you pray about it? Why don't you ask for some help? Why don't you ask for some relief? And there's a sentence in that recovery and relapse chapter, which, by the way, I'm glad everybody's here tonight, and I'm glad you're listening, but if you really want to know about relapse, read the book. There's a chapter called Recovery and Relapse. It will tell you everything you need to know. But it says something in there about, I don't know, something about the sick way that we have this need to fail or this need for pain in our lives, part of being an addict. That haunts me when it comes to working with my higher power. You know, and I can know intellectually in my head that I need to pray. And know from experience that if I do, I will get relief and still not do it. I don't know why. You know, it's just too damn easy to do shit right, to do what people tell you to do sometimes. But it is the strongest thing that I've got, and it works every time. So I'm really, really glad that I'm in Ocean City this weekend. I'm really, really glad I can see who my friends are, because a lot of people said they're going to come support me tonight, and I don't see a lot of them, but I see some of them. I see the ones that count, and I love you guys. I want to thank y'all for coming to, you know, help me out. I feel so much better just knowing that you're out there. And I'd like to thank Jim from the programming committee for asking me to do this meeting. And I thank you guys for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing, Rashima. And, now I'd like to introduce our second speaker, D.H.
Men like giving Men like giving me hugs. I told one of my clients that they get on the hug squad. I said, just look for the girls with the big tits. Anyway, my name is Dee, and I'm an addict. And this is my first convention, and my area is hosting the convention. And Thursday was my 8th anniversary of being clean and crazy. It's been a long time since I've spoken at a meeting, so I might pee my pants. I'm not sure yet. But anyway, at one of my home group meetings, one of the guys that was helping coordinate getting people to speak, you know, said, "Hey, Dee," and just this one just jumped right out at me because I've been through so much that relapse was not an option, but homicide was a sure thought several times. But I'm still clean and I'm still crazy, but anyway, I guess I'll just go back to a little history. I started using when I was 13, came from an alcoholic and abusive household. Mom was the abuser, and I never could understand why my mom, who was supposed to be my protector and all that, you know, would hit on me and my sister, And both me and my sister, my younger brother, and another sister that I didn't know I had until a couple years ago, and I have an older brother, too, that I didn't know I had, all of us have two problems. We're all diagnosed with depressive disorder, and we're also diagnosed as addicts. So I have two things working against me, but two things that I have to work on all the time, and that is my disease and my disorder. I never experienced my depressive disorder without being under the influence of anything, so I never knew I had one. Of course, when you're smoking PCP, you never really know what's going on anyway. But and then when you're drunk and dancing on the bars and pool tables and whatnot and flinging your shirt around, watching it swing around the ceiling fan, you don't give a shit anyhow. So anyway, I wasn't diagnosed with a depressive disorder until my second trip into jail. Now, my first one happened in Baltimore County. And that was at a point in my life when I was ready to die. Prior to that, I couldn't work. I couldn't hold down a job, even as bartending, because I'd get fucked up while at work. And they'd say, dude, we can't have that shit. And I'm like, well, I didn't do nothing. You know, so... So I went to work for an escort service. Now, the money was really good, but I couldn't deal with that. My head, after a while, it was like, I can't do this. I mean, it was, you know, sex is fine, but not with these fucking old dudes, that, you know, and shit like that, you know? I mean, it was like, God. And so, you know, finally I said, fuck this shit. And you know, I'd never really gotten into it. My drug choice is PCP, because when I smoked that, I didn't have to think about nothing. Everything was fine, you know, if you, and I'm surprised that I have any brains left, because, you know, people have told me, you smoked that shit 23 years, you should be like a French fry. And I'm like, well, yeah, right. And I have seen some that are like, what's my name, you know, and shit like that. And sometimes... I just say, thank you from my higher power for keeping my shit together, because here I'm here now. But you know, I started dealing coke because the juice started getting bad. So we started dealing coke, right? And I'd never, you know, really done anything more than snort a few lines in the bathroom with the girls in the bars and shit, you know. But I met this guy, and it's always this guy or this girl, right? And he turned me on to smoking coke. And I thought, you know, what is the big deal with this shit, you know? And then, I mean, I'd watch people take hits, and they're like, I mean, peeking out windows and crap like this, and you know, and I'm like, what in the hell is wrong with y'all? Why are you peeking out the windows? I mean, if the cops are out there, they know what we're doing now. And they're going to kick the fucking door in. So you might as well be, instead of peeking out the windows, doing your last damn hit before they kick the door in, while they're kicking the door in. I could never understand it, you know. And then it went from smoking it to shooting it. And, I mean, I had been deathly afraid of needles. Yeah, I'm afraid of needles, right? But I'd been deathly afraid of needles, you know, as far as getting shots and stuff. But then when I was with this guy, he'd do his shot, and he'd go zoning out. He'd go up and run up to the linen closet, and he's in the linen closet, right? And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, what about me, you know? And so I started doing it myself in my hands. Well, anyway, you know, by that, like I said, by that point, I was ready to, like, man, this is, like, total shit. This is fucked up. But, I mean, I still had it in my head where it's like, okay, you pay rent, you buy food, you buy tampons, you know, you buy shampoo, toilet paper, shit that you need. You don't go and spend the money on that kind of stuff. And this guy was a union iron worker who makes $17 an hour, but he'd rather get fucked up. I'm like, something ain't right here. And, of course, when I would go to work or make any money, it was immediately taken from me. And we'd been evicted 3 times. And, I mean, I got beat up. It was a really fucked up relationship. And he'd beat up me up because I went and paid the rent. And I'm like, what is wrong with this motherfucker? You know, so finally he went to jail because he got caught driving my car with no license. The tags were dead. And I mean, it was like, things are not supposed to be like this. And this was, you know, I got my first DWI in 86, Mother's Day of 86. That was my Mother's Day present. And then four months later. But it was like progressive. My disease was just like progressive, where it was going from okay to fun to real fun. And then it was like, this ain't too happy. And then it was got to where it was really just totally fucked up. So eventually, you know, I got arrested in 94 for possession and distribution of PCP, because we were coming back from D.C. with a bottle of juice, and I'm sitting in the Baltimore County Detention Center, and that was the first time in 20 years I'd ever been clean and sober. So they took away my drugs, they took away my cigarettes, they took away my sex. I'm like, this is fucked up. All of it, take it all away from me at one time, you know? And of course, that jail was just like, it was like a bad movie. And of course, my bond was $50,000, and my mom said, well, I'm sorry, but I've already second mortgaged a house enough, and I can't bail you out. And she said, and then she told me she couldn't love me unconditionally. So a father that I hadn't seen in 35 years is sending me money in jail, and I'm like, and we did eventually meet, because that's another story. But anyway, you know, I sat in jail for 9 months, and the judge said, well, Ms. Wallingford, you could either go to Jessup for up to 4 years, or you could go to rehab. I said, I think I'll go to rehab. So I came back down to Charles County because that's where I'm from, and that's where all my using started, and I proceeded to do my 4 months of inpatient treatment, and the insanity of the illness was I'm never going to do drugs again, but I might drink. But I'd already had 3 DWIs, so tell me how sane is that, you know? But it made sense to me. Plus, I'd already started on some antidepressant medication, and at that time, too, when I was getting ready to get out of rehab, I said, well, was I depressed because of the drugs and the abuse and all that stuff that I went through, or is there something really wrong? So Dr. D said, well, we'll stop the medication and see, you know, how well you do. So I was still going to meetings, had two sponsors, because, you know, I needed one on one side and one on the other. And they were just as nutty as I was. And they both said, no, do not stop taking your medication. So, well, Dee did it her way anyway. And at that time, that's when Melrose Place and all that 90210 was hot on TV. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to my home group meeting tonight because I want to watch 90210. Well, I could have, taped it on the VCR. But, you know, we always come up with an excuse to not do something or do it our way. And as most of us probably know, our way does not work. So eventually, yes, I relapsed because I started to go back around the biker bars where I used to hang out at. You know, like, I can do this. I can hang out, you know, not drink and all that shit. So the third time that I go into the bar is just like it was just another day. Give me Coors Light. And that was all she wrote. And then within 6 months, I was on my way back to jail again because I'd gotten a drug charge when I wasn't even doing drugs at the time. It was just plain out stupidity. If I hadn't relapsed and started drinking, I wouldn't have been in a bar, the situation wouldn't have happened, and I wouldn't be on my way back to jail. So, of course, Charles County, being the one-horse county that it is, said, well, we got us this big-time Baltimore PCP dealer. We're going to hang her ass. Oh, and this was over a joint of green. And I didn't even know it was a joint of green for 6 months. And then so they gave me a year, and I waited 6 months knowing that I was going to jail for a year. And I said, well, fuck, man, I might as well start smoking this shit if I'm going to jail for it, right? So I did, and the shit wasn't no good, or it just wasn't working. I mean, I guess I knew then it was done. I was done with that. But I was still drinking. And then the day before sentencing, you know, people are buying me beers. Oh, yeah, D, like I was going on a trip or some shit, you know? And I'm like, assholes, I'm going to jail for a year. What the fuck? But no matter what I drank, how much I drank, I didn't get drunk. I just knew in my heart that I was done. It was over. I mean, I was 36 years old. I had to do something different because I couldn't keep going like this. I had a daughter who was 19 at the time, and she'd you know, been to the point where she was 10, covering me up, tucking me in bed because I was so drunk, or telling me how lunched out I was when she was 12, or that I was a green bean, you know, and all this shit. And that it was like, it was the role reverse where she was mommy and I was the kid. And some of us probably been through that with our own kids. And there was a lot of damage there. You know, I never was a physical abuser, but there was that emotional abuse. So I went into jail and I got down on my knees one day and I never prayed about nothing except like in being in the courtroom, God, get me out of this shit, you know? And I said, God, help me to do what I need to do to get my life straightened out. And it was like, from that moment on, everything, even though I was in jail, everything just seemed to start changing within me somehow, some way, something. And so I went back to did my time there and went back to the rehab that I'd been in the first time, which is also the rehab that I work at now. And it is really ironic. Got out. I mean, I didn't really need to go there, but I wanted to go there. I mean, because I knew I was done and I knew what I needed to do. But I went back, got out, and while I was there, I got diagnosed with major depressive disorder, recurrent episode, and so got on medication. And some people have a thing about, you know, disorders and medication and stuff, but it worked for me. It's helped me stay clean crazy. Anyway, it helped me a lot, and I was in therapy for 4 years after I began my recovery, and it helped me to find out who Dee was, because I didn't know who I was. I mean, I went from Barbie dolls, playing beauty parlor and all that shit, to getting high and eventually hanging out with the bikers and all. Not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with bikers, no way, but you know, it just it went from one thing to a whole totally different movie, just like that. And so got out of jail, got out of rehab. My daughter was by now 21, and she was pregnant with my first grandchild. I have three now, and they've never seen Mima do anything but wig out. And they'll never see Mima any high, not high, nothing. But I started going to school, and by the time I accumulated 2.5 years clean time, and I started working at social services. And I said, hey, man, I'm working for the state. The paycheck from the state's a whole lot better than doing time for the state. And I was working at family services, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to work with kids, you know, from bad families, and I'm going to save the world and all this shit. Well, after working with teenagers, I said, the hell with this? And I also had told myself, too, that I would never be a counselor. I said, man, I couldn't deal with that shit. But, you know, the health department in my county, they were hiring. And I went and applied and got the job. But when I got there, I knew that that's where I needed to be. And so it's been 4.5 years now I've been a counselor. But I left my job in August of 99, 2 years ago, 2002, because I was having problems with my back, and I'm still having problems with them. They stuck needles in me, and they want to do more and all this crap, and there ain't nothing wrong with rear end action, but not with the needles. Anyway, I didn't mean that, like, yeah, right, I know. I met the guy that I'm married to now, and when I first met him, he was a total drunk. I mean, and I'm like, he was with this ugliest chick I'd ever seen in my life. And I'm like, that motherfucker must be fucked up, because, I mean, he is with this ugly, she had, like, no teeth and, you know, was huge, and I'm like, anyway. But this connection between me and him, you know, evolved, and he went to jail, and I was trying to help him when he got out, and, you know, and it was, my intention was to just, you know, go to meetings, hang out, and whatever, and be friends, because I'd just gotten out of a relationship with a dude that was in a one percenter club, and I was like, man, I'm like, I need to just be by myself for a while. So I don't know what happened, but you know how things go, And then eventually he asked me to marry him, and, like, that was February of 2002, and he asked me to marry him, and 4 months later we got married, and like I hadn't been married in 25 years, and I did this straight. So, but it was cool, you know, because he was in recovery too. He was going on 3 years being sober, and we were going to meetings, and everything was hunky-dory, and I was like, oh man, I found me the man, you know, that makes decent money, and he's loving, and he's clean and sober and blah, 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 and all this shit. Well, I didn't know that he had half a storage bin full of baggage. And I didn't find all this shit out till after we had moved into a house and I had left my job and went on leave of absence because of the health problems and shit. And things started to change, not with me, with him. He started getting nasty, and of course, by the time we'd moved to another county, our meetings had slowed down. He'd started his own diesel repair business, and he was focusing on mostly on that, and it was stress. And he'd never really learned how to deal with stress and anxiety appropriately. And I kept trying to help him, you know, like here I am, the clean and sober wife and the counselor that he ain't even listening to, nothing I was saying. So, make long story short, we had to move again. We moved, well, we only had a short lease, but we moved again, and things started getting worse because I still wasn't working. But I was doing what I was doing. I was selling stuff on eBay, so I was making sure that, you know, I was paying, doing my part because I've never not took care of myself, and I felt like I was a burden. And I mean, so I was dealing with my own shit, and my depression started kicking up, and I didn't recognize it at first, and I'd never experienced it while I was totally clean and sober, so it was scary. And he'd never experienced anybody with a disorder like that, so he didn't know what the hell was going on either. So for fast forward a little bit, I noticed some things started getting a little strange, you know, like his Harley Davidson jeans, couldn't find them, and he'd try to make me believe that I might have put them somewhere. I'm like, no, I don't think so. I might have smoked a lot of green, but I ain't burn out, you know. And so I started delivering newspapers because I said, I can't take this shit. I can't take, you know, his degrading me and harassing me about, you know, being a burden to him and shit. And so I started delivering newspapers even though I shouldn't have been working. And I came home 6 o'clock one morning, and I could tell that he'd been drinking. And I just calmly said, you know, is this the first time you've drank? And he said, yeah. And he said he didn't want to drink. So the next, that same morning, he went, and we were going to meet back at the house that later on after we both did our chores, and he was fucked up. He'd already drank a fifth and a half of vodka, and that was the way he did drink. It was no problem for him to drink a fifth. Now, me, I'd been puking and passed out and all that shit. And he said he needed to drink so that he could tell me what he needed to tell me, and I was like, oh, my God, what is this? Well, he'd screwed my sister, helped her buy a Harley, and was always bitching to me about money and shit, and I'm like, well, let's see, $4,000, I mean, that would have been what might have gone to child support and shit. And so then after that, he went outside, came back in, and started shooting the house up and putting the gun to his head. And, I mean, I'm, like, freaking out. And so, make long story short, he got arrested. He's now in jail. He's had an evaluation. He has a depressive disorder, too. And he's trying to go into an inpatient treatment. But throughout all of that shit that he dished out to me and all the shit that I had to go through and what I'm still going through now, relapse was not an option for me, although I did think about homicide several times. But that was not an option either because I wasn't going to jail over somebody else's crap. And people have asked me, well, you know, how did you deal with that shit, and why are you still dealing with it now? And I'm like, well, if I wasn't in recovery and I wasn't a counselor, I wouldn't have seen the train of relapse coming at me, but there wasn't nothing I could do except, you know, just wave and hope that he would pay attention. But, you know, I couldn't stop that. I couldn't stop what he was doing. I could only control me. So I had to do what we have to do for ourselves, and that is I had to go back to meetings. I had to read my literature. I had to get on the damn phone. Otherwise, I would end up in the nut house or, you know, somewhere. And it just wasn't an option, and it's still not an option. And today, you know, he's doing his time for all the foul shit he did. Plus, he also has to live with himself for what all the shit he did to me. And what I have to work on today is resentment and forgiveness, because I do love him, but if I wasn't as strong as I am and as serious about my recovery, I wouldn't be clean and sober today, and he'd be dead, and I'd probably be in jail. And I did go back to work in December at the inpatient facility where I'm at, and it's helped me to see that that is where I need to be. And relapse is not an option, no matter what. You know, I've had friends die. I've seen people do foul shit. But the only thing that you can do is try to help them to pick themselves back up and get them right back into where we're all at right now, into a meeting. And this is where I've been for 8 years, and this is where I'm staying. So thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for sharing, Dee. And before we open the meeting up for those who'd like to share, please remember to come up to the podium one at a time. And also, please keep in mind that there are other addicts who may want to share. The meeting's open for anybody who...
Hello, my name is Victor, and I'm an alcoholic. I went to a little relapse one time, and what happened at that time is I came out of a short program, a visa inpatient program, and it was a four-week program. And I had the intention really of staying clean. I went up there to a halfway house, which was suggested at the time. And I had the intention of doing it right, but then I called the wrong person, though, because I called somebody who I knew at the time, and he mentioned something to me. Hey, if you would have told us you needed a place to stay, you wouldn't need to be in that halfway house. You could stay here. And then she mentioned something about working for her, giving me a place to stay, and paying me good, and this and that. And next thing I know, I changed my mind. I remember going with them through meetings, and I really didn't like what they was doing. I remember that I was told about doing chores and helping out, and I didn't like that either. So I opted for going to this place. And I remember being told at that time by the counselor that, no, don't put your recovery on jeopardy, because you know that's gonna happen. But that didn't change my mind. I went out, and I stayed working at this place, and I lasted clean only exactly 32 days, because after 32 days, what happened is that the place that I was working with, there was a lot of drinking going around, and I was just like, you know, just staying like this, looking around and seeing this happening, but I still wasn't doing it. But on the 32nd day, I said, the hell with it, and I started drinking, and it got truly worse. If you think that little relapse you might do, be successful using, believe me, there is no way of successful using, really, because it got really worse. And it put me out there, through a long story, really, though, but it got really worse, because I end up living in shelters, I end up on the streets with no place to stay. And if it was only because of the mercy of God about recovery housing I can, which is in Baltimore, I end up in there on January 5th of 2000. That was my last day, the last day that I truly drank. And that was, four years and some change ago. But what I noticed this time around is that I stayed connected. I kept going to meetings. I got me a, I think the best sponsor is the guy who got me here. I got a good homebrew, you know. I attend to almost every week. I'm a treasurer, and I'm doing a lot of things that I wasn't doing. And I truly think that that's the reason that I'm 4 years and stuff. Because believe me, if it wasn't for that, they're saying that people after a certain amount of time, they just don't go to meetings and stay clean. But I know for me that if I wasn't coming to meetings or anything, believe me, I don't think there is a way possible that I'd be clean. And that's all I got.
Thanks for sharing. We still have a couple more minutes before we bring this workshop to a close. Does anyone else would like to come up here and share? If not, thank you for everybody for sharing and